this is how I know I'm against chaining up dogs. Is being, whoa, this is going to be scary. Good morning. It's good to see everyone out this morning. For those of you virtually watching, if you see the carpet all of a sudden or just the ceiling, you'll know that I backed too far up. It is good to see everyone out this morning, and we're going to finish up this series of Lifted Up with the story of the resurrection of Jesus. We're also, of course, coming up on Thanksgiving. Of course, by the look of me, you can tell that it's my favorite holiday. And I guess as a preacher now, I should say it's the best, not because of the turkey and the dressing and the sweet potatoes and the pie and things like that. I should say that it's good because of the Thanksgiving and the gratitude and all of those things. So that's what we will go with. We're good. We're happy for that this month. It's good, though, to spend time thinking about the things that we are thankful for. So what are you thankful for? What are the things, especially this month, what are the things that you were thinking about? Maybe your family, your friends, your health, your home, all of those things are good things. Things for which we ought to be thankful for. Things for which that we ought to take some time and say thank you, God, that I am so incredibly blessed. But may I suggest, as you count your blessings, put the resurrection of Jesus Christ at the top of your list. Not only should we weigh all the other good things that we have in this world against this and say all of these things are good things, but they're not quite as good as the empty tomb. Even more important than that, than weighing all of those good things against the resurrection, it's more important too that we weigh all of the bad things against the resurrection of Jesus. I read an article written by a man whose two-year-old had died a few years ago. And he said for him, it was the empty tomb that was the thing for which he was the most thankful for. That the thing that gives him joy, in spite of the pain, in spite of his grief, and we all have those things that come in and we weigh them against the resurrection and we say, but Jesus wins. And isn't that what we've been trying to say this last month, is that Jesus wins? The resurrection of Jesus means that everything is different right now. Pain still hurts. Sorrow is still heavy. Grief is still something that we must bear. Death is still an enemy. But we know, Christians know, how it all ends. So we rejoice and we thank God for all of the good in our life and in this world. And at the very top of our list is the fact that the tomb is empty. So let's read and let's think about the resurrection of Jesus, where we've been going through John all of this year, and we're about to wrap it up. We're going to be in John chapter 20. Jesus has been crucified, and as we said last week, though, on the surface, this is a horrible thing that has happened, but John keeps saying, but it's not. Jesus is in charge. Even though they're doing this mockingly by putting a crown of thorns on his head and saying, Hail, King of the Jews, even though they are doing it mockingly and they mean it for evil, God means it for good and for every bit of truth. And Jesus is being lifted up, not in spite of the cross, but through the cross. Jesus is being lifted up as King of Kings, and the truth is being proclaimed that he really is not just King of the Jews, but King of the world. Now we read the best part of the story. Verse 1, John chapter 20. Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. And I want us to imagine this morning it's all about putting ourselves in the story. Just imagine you came to the grave 3 days after a funeral for somebody that you were willing to turn your whole life over for. Someone you were willing to turn your whole world upside down. Someone in whom you've put in all your hopes and your dreams, and you've said, this person is so different. They are going to change the world. There's no telling what this person can do. And then they die. Then a few days later, you go to their grave, and the grave is empty. In our sense, it would be a hole in the ground, and that hole is empty. How would you feel? You would panic. And that's exactly what Mary did here. And I want you to notice, again, as you read through this chapter, you will see that John uses the word saw and seen over and over and over again. He wants us to know what the people are seeing. So if we're going to read this story the way that John wants us to, you have to see it. Imagine Mary Magdalene, and we know from the other accounts that she's not alone, but she gets to the tomb and it's empty. And verse 2 says, so she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, that's the guy writing this book, and said to them, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb and we do not know where they have laid him. So Peter went out with the other disciple and they were going toward the tomb. Both of them were running together. And again, just imagine the panic and the adrenaline. They're running together, but the other disciple, John, who is the author, and I like that John does this, he said, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And I think it's really great that John is giving us an eyewitness account, and he's just like, I'm just reporting the facts here, and I'm faster than Peter. I don't know what else to tell you guys. But I also imagine Peter, every time he read this, just kind of rolling his eyes. But it continues on and says, and stooping in, he saw the linen cloths lying there. But he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb. And what's the word there? He saw the linen cloths lying there and the face cloth, which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded up in a place by itself. Why is this significant? Why is this significant that not only is there no body, but all of the cloths that have been wrapped around him, even the face cloth, were lying there? In fact, we're told the face cloth was folded and lying separate. Why is that significant? Because what is it that Mary Magdalene had come and said to the men? She said, listen, I'm afraid somebody has stolen his body. But when you get to the scene, something doesn't quite make sense. If his body had been stolen, why are all the cloths still there? Why is the face cloth folded up? That doesn't make any sense. What kind of first century grave robber unwraps a body and then leaves the cloth, much less takes time to fold the face cloth and leave it there? That doesn't make any sense. And the men knew it, and they saw it. And it says that the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, again, just saying here, who also went in, and he saw, and John uses another one of his favorite words here, he saw and believed. Maybe John didn't say anything at this point, but he's writing his account so we know what he's thinking. He's telling us, I saw. Well, what did he see? He didn't see Jesus. He just saw an empty tomb. But he saw the cloth lying there, and he saw the face cloth folded up. And John says he saw and he believed. For as of yet, they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. John says, listen, I saw it, but I didn't get the big picture yet. I didn't understand, because later, not only John, but Peter and all of the disciples of Jesus would say, yes, of course, this is the only way that the scriptures make any sense. This is what the scriptures have been talking about. This is the whole story, what God has been saying, that God will not abandon his Messiah to the grave, that he will not abandon the Messiah in Hades, but his Messiah will rise and rule the world. They didn't understand that just quite yet, but they did understand that the tomb was empty and the body wasn't stolen, because that wouldn't have made any sense. It says that the disciples went back to their homes. I guess they must have just walked right past Mary. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb, and as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. And they said to her, woman, why are you weeping? And she said to them, they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him. Having said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing, but did not know it was Jesus. And do you see here how John is putting this all together for us? The order in which he is putting it, the words that he is using, that they saw this and they started drawing some conclusions. And then they saw this and they started drawing a few more conclusions. Nobody had put the big picture together yet, but they were starting to collect the clues. They were starting to put the evidence together. They are seeing it. It is unfolding before their eyes. And it says that Mary turned around and saw Jesus standing, but she did not know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." And can't you just feel the weight of Mary's heart? You can imagine her showing up at the grave of your friend, of your master, of the one you follow. And we don't really even understand that word, follow. But to leave home and family and say, "I'm with him no matter what it costs me. I'm with him." And then he's gone. And then you show up at his grave and his body is gone. And some guy walks up while you're crying and he asks you what your problem is, why you're crying. And you say, "Listen, if you're the gardener and you've taken his body away, just tell me and I'll come get it." And Jesus said to her, "Mary." And I know she's recognized his voice. She's heard her name come out of his mouth probably a million times. And she turned to him and she said in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Now, not only try to imagine what she is feeling in that moment, but imagine how hard it would have been to say, "Teacher," to admit to yourself that it's him. Just moments before she was convinced his body was stolen, now she hears his voice saying her name, and she turns and looks at him, and she knows who it is. But don't you know, in that moment of grief and sorrow, you wouldn't want to say the name or the word teacher. You would hold on, and you'd say, "Wait, maybe. Could this be possible?" And then she's convinced, and she's thinking in her mind that it's him, and she shouts, "Rabboni," and Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." And next week, we will start our final series of 2020, and it's going to talk about this part of the story. What does it mean for Jesus to sit at the right hand of God? But we're going to save that for next week. Let's go to verse 18. It says that Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, best phrase probably of the whole account, "I have seen the Lord. He's not stolen. He's not even dead. I have seen the Lord, and he has said these things to her." And we just read those words, "I have seen the Lord," but can you imagine the joy that is packed into those words? The gratitude, the thankfulness, the trembling of her voice when she announces it to the disciples. "Listen, I have seen the Lord. Everything he has said is coming true." Everything that we were trying to figure out, what he was talking about being killed and in 3 days being raised from the dead. What does this mean? It's all true. He's not dead. "I have seen the Lord." And verse 19 says, "On that evening of that day, the first day of the week, the doors being locked where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them. The doors are locked, and Jesus walks in and says to them, 'Peace be with you.' And when he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. And then his disciples were glad." And then they, what? Saw the Lord. They were glad when they saw the Lord. And that really sounds like an understatement, doesn't it? They saw the Lord. And notice here that this isn't a ghost. This isn't a spirit. It's not a disembodied spirit. It is Jesus bodily raised. Not only not in the tomb any longer, but still showing the wounds in his hands and in his side where the spear was driven. But also in a way a little bit different too. He's walking in to locked rooms. But it is Jesus, bodily raised from the dead, and the disciples saw him. This isn't something they imagined. This isn't even wishful thinking. Every single one of them was a skeptic when it came to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. They were skeptical. When they first heard about the empty tomb, their first thoughts didn't go to, "Well, he must be raised from the dead. That's what he said he was going to do." No. They had to see him. They had to see Jesus before their hearts could be convinced. But of course, when they were convinced, they were glad. And this changes everything. So Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, even so I am sending you." That's what apostle means, one who is sent. And when he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. If you withhold forgiveness from any, it is withheld." It's sort of a foreshadow of the day of Pentecost when the Holy Spirit is breathed into them and they begin to first announce to the Jews in Jerusalem the forgiveness of sins, and 3,000 are baptized into Jesus, forgiven of their sins, and then they are sent out into the whole world to announce that we have seen the Lord, that Jesus lives. Jesus forgives and Jesus reigns. Verse 24 tells us that now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, here's that phrase again, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger into the mark of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe. And we give Thomas kind of a hard time here, don't we? What do we call him? This right here is why we call him Doubting Thomas. Poor guy. He gets this moniker for the rest of time. And really, what does he want to do? He wants to see. He's no different from the other guys. They all saw, and they didn't believe until they saw. Thomas wants to see. Thomas says, listen, I'm not going to believe until I see. He might should have, but he didn't until he had the same experience they had. He wanted to see the body of Jesus. He wanted the same opportunity. So verse 26 tells us that 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. And although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it into my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." And Thomas answered him again some very profound words, "My Lord and my God." Finally, I see the big picture. This is who he is. Thomas sees and Thomas believes. And we might think, as I read this, I think, man, I would like that experience too. I want to see that. I want to see the risen Jesus. I want to see his wounds. I want to have the same experience that the disciples have. Why is it that they got that opportunity and we have to just simply trust their word? But listen to the next verse. Jesus said to them, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen but yet have believed." And that word blessed means somebody who has the life. We use that phrase, the life. You know, you see someone who is enjoying something and you say, that person has the life. Or when they post stuff on social media, it's things like hashtag blessed, those kinds of things. They say, this is the life. And Jesus says, no, listen, you want to know who has the life? You want to know who is really blessed, who is blessed beyond those who saw and who touched and experienced this visual confirmation of the resurrection of Jesus? Do you want to know who's blessed beyond them? You. You are. You who haven't seen yet believed. You've listened to these, as John is trying to make us aware, these eyewitness accounts, these eyewitness testimonies. Over and over and over again, he uses that phrase, he saw, she saw, they saw. And now he is telling you, we saw him. We were skeptical, but we saw him and we believe. And now Jesus is telling you, if you believe, even if you haven't seen yet, you are the most blessed people on the face of the earth. That's it. The next verse says, now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written, why? So that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Life now and life forever. Life in this age and life in the age to come. You are the most blessed people because even though you haven't yet seen, you believe. And that's a wonderful thing. That's why we believe, and now we are telling you so that even though you can't see, that you will believe, and that by believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the God, Son of God, you will have life in His name. And every week we go through a passage and we try to think through, what is my application for this? What do I do with this information? Well, first the text tells us what to do. Believe. Believe and also rejoice that you are blessed to have a life in His name. I may have told this story before, but there's a really grumpy man who worked with the minister, and they were in a meeting, and the preacher said something that the guy didn't really care for, and the man turned to the preacher and he said, if Jesus heard you say that, he would roll over in his grave. Wait a second. If Jesus is in his grave, what are we doing here? That makes us realize something. There are many behaviors and attitudes that do not make sense in light of the empty tomb. Think about that for a second. If Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, if He is not in His grave, but He reigns and He lives and He forgives and He gives life, then there are certain attitudes and behaviors that don't make sense. That's what the rest of the New Testament is about. It's about the apostles explaining to the followers of Jesus, in light of the death and the resurrection of Jesus, that behavior does or does not make sense. Pettiness does not make sense in light of the empty tomb. Being perpetually grumpy does not make sense in light of the empty tomb. Being bitter doesn't make sense in light of the empty tomb. Being jealous doesn't make sense in light of the empty tomb. Being hedonist, where you just live for pleasure, doesn't make sense in light of the empty tomb. But the opposite is also true as well. There are attitudes and behaviors that only make sense in light of the empty tomb. There are certain attitudes and behaviors that only make sense if Jesus lives, if Jesus reigns, if Jesus forgives. Why else would we give so much of ourselves away? Why else would we love the way that we love, except for the empty tomb? The love that Jesus tells us to love with only makes sense in light of the empty tomb. The joy that we have only makes sense in light of the empty tomb. The peace that passes all understanding only makes sense in light of the empty tomb. That gentleness and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and self-control that Jesus teaches us to practice only makes sense in light of the empty tomb. So our moment of truth question this morning, how does your life reflect the gratitude and the joy and the attitude and behaviors that come with the empty tomb? I know that if you ask that grumpy man in that meeting, you know, man, that Jesus is raised, right? He would have said yes. But that moment betrayed his thoughts. In that moment, he betrayed the way he was truly living his life. He wasn't living his life in light of the empty tomb. If he was, he would have never said that. Jesus lives. Jesus reigns. Jesus is living and reigning. And the only thing that makes this life make sense is that. As we get closer to Thanksgiving and then we think about those things for which we are thankful for as we gather as families, as we enjoy food and enjoy our lives together, and we do our best to allow the Spirit of God to produce fruit in us. Paul talks about them, love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness, gentleness and self-control. We must live with the empty tomb at the forefront of our minds. We have to ask ourselves, how does our life reflect that gratitude and joy that only comes in light of the empty tomb? Maybe there's someone here this morning in light of the death and the resurrection of Jesus. You are ready to be buried with Him in baptism so that you can be raised up from the water and live and walk in a newness of life. Maybe you just need prayers. And I know I say this every week and we're about to wrap up, but we know, we all know, each of us have heavy burdens. Burdens, though, that we can't know about and help you carry if you don't share them with someone somehow. In light of the empty tomb, in light of who we are, we want to help you with those burdens. Not to tell you they really aren't that heavy. Not to tell you to suck it up and keep moving on. Not to give you empty platitudes where we say things like, oh, well, we're praying for you and we love you so much. but to seriously and honestly encourage you and pray with you and pray for you and walk with you, because that's what followers of Jesus do. Please let us know as together we stand and we sing.